Hey everyone, it's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I want to welcome you to our midweek video this week. We're certainly glad that you have joined us and tuned in. Appreciate you doing that. I want to welcome you to our YouTube channel here. If you haven't already done so, if you consider subscribing and ringing the alarm bell as a way of staying current with the ministry, when we go live from the Assembly Building on Sunday mornings, as well as when we create content for you here midweek, we would certainly appreciate that. Featured book this week is, again, my book, Don't Pass Over Easter, A New Defense of Easter in Acts 12:4. This book deals with the controversial reading of Easter in Acts 12:4, and it is ultimately defending the reading, but it offers a little bit of a different take than maybe what some people have traditionally or historically argued when it comes to that issue. So if you would consider picking up a copy of that book as a way of supporting the ministry, we would certainly appreciate that. Also want to remind you about our Rumble channel here, Grace Life Bible Church on Rumble. We established this as an alt-text site should something happen to our YouTube ministry. So if you're into alt-text sites or would like an alternative to YouTube, please consider checking us out, subscribing here on Rumble as well. Those of you who have been following the channel, you know that midweek I've been giving my thoughts on the Textual Confidence Collective. And I am trying to figure out how to sort of wrap this up. Not sure how many more there's going to be in this particular series. This could be the last one. I just have to give that a little bit more thought. But there is kind of one more thing I wanted to say regarding to what we've been discussing of late, particularly in the last two episodes. And that is, is it true that textual variants don't impact doctrine? So in episode 15, which is currently covered here by my window, we looked at Mark 16, the last 12 verses in Mark, and investigated, is it true that excising those verses from the text doesn't impact any doctrine? And we focused particularly on the issue of the bodily ascension of the Lord Jesus Christ, which is found in those verses, which would be taken out of Mark's gospel if Mark, the last 12 verses of Mark were deemed to be inauthentic. And then the last video, we looked at 1 John 5:7, and we talked about, again, as another example of the statement, is it true that textual variants don't impact doctrine? And then we framed that conversation, the last one, by looking at Dr. Theodore Leitis's doctoral thesis, where he really investigates the history of all of that and gets to the bottom of where that mantra came from, that no text variants impact doctrine, and the historical context in which that developed. So I would strongly encourage you, if you haven't watched 15 and 16, which are the precursors to this one that I'm making right now, 17, please consider doing that, maybe even before you watch this one, if you're so inclined. So we've been responding in this series to the Textual Confidence Collective. This is a series of podcasts, YouTube videos that were produced last summer in 2022. And it is now nearly the end of January 2023. But I have just elected to kind of take these things slowly, offer my thoughts. When these videos first came out, I was in the middle of a different series related to why grammar matters in Bible study. And so I didn't want to lay that aside. I finished that before I started this. So we've been working on this now throughout the fall and now early winter. And so we'll be done with giving my thoughts on this particular thing shortly, okay? And more recently, we have been talking about some things that Brother Ward said. Brother Ward, I perceive him to be the leader of the Textual Confidence Collective, and he wrote some things in his book here, Authorized, the Use and Misuse of the King James Bible. And this is just giving me problems here, so I apologize for why that won't. Anyway, in Use and Misuse of the King James, it's going to start playing again. Brother Ward gives, he cites the work of Dr. Randy Leedy, and here is Dr. Randy Leedy's essay. You can find this on Logos, and I don't know if my internet just reset here in the middle of all this or what have you, but I had all this queued up before I started. What I normally do is I like storyboard out here what I want to cover, and then I have some short notes and so forth. I'm not using a teleprompter or anything like that. I haven't got that fancy or what have you. But anyway, we've been talking about what Brother Ward says and authorized the use and misuse of the King James Bible, particularly on pages 114 through 117, where he has a section, modern versions are based on inferior Greek and Hebrew texts. And he is quoting and citing this article, this piece from Dr. Randy Leedy. And he's doing the same thing in this video right here. Should differences in biblical manuscripts scare Christians? Okay, and that you'll notice that that's basically the same title as Dr. Leedy's piece. And they basically give two reasons why. Okay, so let me just read. This is from page 114 of Authorized. First, Dr. Leedy points out that there are no Christian groups or theological persuasions that claim a particular Greek manuscript or family of manuscripts. He says, we have lots of doctrinal differences within Christianity, right? But there are no Calvinist manuscript versions, Arminian manuscript versions, Pentecostal, Reformed, Presbyterian, Episcopal, Congregationalist, Egalitarian, Complementarian, Cessationist, etc. Pick up pretty much any theology book in existence, no matter its theological perspective, and it would cite biblical references without specifying which translation you should look them up. So the first reason why Christians shouldn't care is because there are no denominational, sectarian manuscripts / printed editions of the Greek text or translations. That is reason number one. And you can see that that is definitely the case here. No theological denominations claim a particular text. And then later on page 115, the second issue is, dealt with. And that is, even if we had absolutely perfect copies, the work of interpretation would still need to be done. And on page 115, Brother Ward says, quote, second, even if we had pristinely perfect and completely identical copies of the Greek New Testament with no typos whatsoever, we still have the hard work to interpret them just like we do now. Leedy observes, quote, my weaknesses as a reader expose me to far more significant misunderstandings than the manuscript differences do. So by far, the greatest problem that God must overcome in order to talk to me are within me, not within the transmission process. So Brother Ward covers this in about a 10-minute, 11-minute video here, where he's basically expanding on what Brother Leedy said in this article, as well as a few of the statements there that he made in Authorized. Okay, so the idea is that while there's two basic assumptions. Okay, number one, there are no sectarian denominational manuscripts / translations, and that even if there were perfect, pristine perfection in the transmission of the text, that does not do away with the interpretive problem that people are going to interpret the same text differently. Okay, so these are the reasons given for why Christians should not be scared by text variants, by the fact that, let's go back to the top of this, by the fact that, there are differences in biblical manuscripts. Okay, now, so I have a couple, thoughts on that. Number one, there are examples in history where specific translations have been made, particularly Unitarian ones. Now, Brother Ward would probably respond to that by saying, well, but those aren't accepted by the majority of the church, so to speak, which would not be wrong. But I do think that to the second point, how can you interpret? You don't even have a chance to interpret accurately if the text you're interpreting is in question. If the text you're interpreting, there is variation to the degree that people are concerned or not sure what the text even should be, how does anyone have a chance to accurately interpret a text that's in dispute? Okay, now we've seen this in the previous videos in this series, in the two examples, particularly in the one on number 16, where we talked about 1 John 5:7. We've seen a whole swath of history in the last episode, episode 16, of people who literally began to question the Trinity, the deity of Christ, the virgin birth, as we followed that progression through Dr. Leedy's doctoral thesis, precisely because of text variants. So the only reason that these things don't scare Christians, if I could say it that way, is because the evangelical academia tells its listeners that they don't need to be afraid of them. But that has certainly not historically been the case, as we saw in the last video. There are many examples of Christians, of people within the realm of Protestantism, whose faith was was weakened, if not damaged, in some cases maybe even overthrown, precisely because of the variance, as we saw in the last video. Okay. Now, there was one issue in the notes from lesson 80 that I went through in the last episode, episode 16, that we didn't get to, and I said I was specifically holding off on that till the next one, which would be this one I'm making right now, number 17, and that is to look at the reception that the Revised Version got in Great Britain in 1881 when it was published. And we want to look at this particularly through the lens of, did people at the time, in the late 19th century, when it came out and they read it, did they perceive that, it doesn't matter, there's no doctrinal differences here, and, you know, this is just updated language, updated ways of saying things, and none of this impacts doctrine or how we should understand the text and what the text is saying? Was that the reaction of people? Now, certainly there were people, maybe, who had that reaction, but there are a lot of people who, when they read it for the first time, were extremely alarmed and were concerned that what they were reading was impacting doctrine. So we want to look at a sample. I'm only going to go through four examples. There are many more that we could go through, but I've picked four of varying lengths, and we're going to look at a few of these. Okay. So again, remember, we're looking at this through the lens or through the prism of, was it understood that, according to modern evangelical thinking, that no text variant or no difference in translation impacts doctrine? Was that an idea that people had when the Revised Version first came out? And we're looking at this from a historical perspective, okay? So this statement right here, this quote from Leetus's doctoral thesis, is sort of, as we've funneled everything down now through what we went through in episode 15, episode 16, this is what Leetus says. The net impact of these textual controversies within British academia from the 18th century on the popular biblical discourse was not seen until the 19th century with the publication of the Revised Version in 1881. Here's what Leetus says, quote, that the ecclesiastical world did in fact take note of the textual decisions made by the Unitarians and eventually took in hand to, quote, improve the established church's Bible in 1881 with a Unitarian sitting on the revision committee. See, nobody wants to talk about this. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that on the revision committee sat a Unitarian, George Van Smith. George Van Smith, as we'll see in a minute, wrote a book commenting on it, precisely how the choices of the revision committee impact the doctrine that was communicated by the Revised Version. So this Unitarian on the revision committee, Leetus is pointing out, is the net effect of a slow, creeping, changing situation and understanding of text variants affecting the text, affecting the way the historic, affecting the way Christ is viewed, etc. And now we end up with a Unitarian on the revision committee. This is a fact, this is a historical fact that I feel that modern version advocates never, they don't really address this. They don't want people to know about this. I don't say that in a conspiratorial way, but it is an inconvenient fact for the overall argumentation of what they're trying to get evangelical Christianity to buy into, okay? With a Unitarian sitting on the revision committee was surely the most significant indication possible that the anti-Trinitarians' long campaign had not been in vain. In the revised edition, both 1 Timothy 3:16 and the Coma Johannine were treated precisely as Erasmus had hinted they ought to be. Was expunged from the text, and the Coma was now removed without so much as a note to signal that it was ever there. Okay? So those are both true statements. from Letus as you look at the revised version, Revised New Testament of 1881. So, published in the spring of 1881, the revised version was quickly critiqued in the British press. It was praised by Unitarians and theological liberals, while it was mourned by the theologically conservative. Both parties could plainly see that the readings impacted, quote, the fundamental doctrines of the Christian faith. Okay, so let's look at a few things. This is May 26, 1881. The issue of the Free Religious Index ran a piece titled The New Testament, which stated the following about the newly revised version. Okay, so that's this piece right here, the Free Religious Index. This is a weekly paper devoted to free religion, Volume 1, Series 2. You can see that this is published from, this particular copy is from 1880 to 1881. So let's jump in here and go to page 103. If we go to page 103 of this document, you can see an issue published in May 26, 1881. And we can scroll down, I think, if my computer will cooperate. And I think I just went too far, maybe. We are looking at this paragraph, I believe, right in here when we look at this quote. Okay, yes, and we think, and you can see right here, and we think, all right, but I am going to read it off of my notes because it's easier to read. Quote, and we think one of the certain effects of this acceptance of the revised version will be the increase of more rational views about the Bible. A book that can be amended cannot be infallible. So now you know the point of view of the Free Religious Index. They are skeptics. They are saying that they are embracing Enlightenment rationalism. Okay? A book that can be amended cannot be infallible, yet thousands of readers of the King James have read it in the firm belief that they were reading an infallible book. So before 1881, there were a bunch of English-speaking Christians who were, and I've covered this in a host of other videos, who believed that their English Bible that they had in front of them in the King James was infallible. The Free Religious Index is saying this, and they're saying that that's irrational, that for somebody to believe that, okay? Now, they will now begin to see that belief, at least, was a mistake. But since no claim is made that the new revising committee has been inspired, and their process of working with the instrumentalities of human scholarship is even frankly described, have these readers an infallible book now? See, they're mocking Protestant belief. Have all mistakes been corrected? And these manuscripts that are talked about, on what authority do they rest? And so the question of infallibility, having been started among the readers who never raised it before, will not rest until it reached the question of original authorship. This is exactly what Letus was arguing in his doctoral thesis, that lower criticism leads to higher criticism. Now, in the case of the collective, I'm not saying that those men are doubting the divinity, virgin birth, Trinitarian things. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, though, I'm addressing the principles, the concept that none of this impacts doctrine, and that Christians don't need to worry about the differences in biblical manuscripts because we, the Evangelical Academy, are telling them they don't need to. But there's a host of evidence that people of the day knew exactly what was going on. But see, now we're over 100, nearly 150 years removed from all of this, and people aren't aware of this history of what was said at the time. Okay? Let me start this over. So the question of infallibility, having once been started among the readers who never raised it before, it may not rest until it reached the question of original authorship, and the popular theories of the Bible be reconstructed on a more rational basis. From this point of view, therefore, the Revised New Testament has a special interest for liberals. Okay? Theological liberals are rejoicing over the publication of the Revised New Testament. That the revision on points where any doctrinal change is involved favors liberal Christianity rather than orthodox interpretation is also apparent. There is no way that observers of the Revised Version did not see and understand through the lenses of their historical context and what was going on that this was not a weakening of Orthodox Protestantism. But this is a matter of much less moment than setting the reader's wits on the question of whether the Bible he is reading is an infallible book. Let the question once fairly get started among the plain thinking people of Christendom in the 19th century, and the 20th century will answer it by placing the Bible on the library shelves alongside of other historical religious books classified as one of the human literatures of the world's religions. I would argue that's exactly what happened. That is exactly what happened. The 20th century saw the placing of the Bible to the side, and there was an inestimable damage to the cause of Christian orthodoxy here. And these guys are saying it. Now, again, I'm not saying that the guys on the collective are not orthodox in their belief about Christ. That is not what I'm saying. I'm simply trying to historically demonstrate that the idea that is confessed here, that they shouldn't worry about these things, or that these things don't matter, or that, you know, well, you know, parallel influence, harmonization, we don't need to worry about these things because they're taught elsewhere, that idea that none of this impacted doctrine is simply not the case. Okay, let's move on to my second example. My second example is from the Dublin Review from July through October 1881, contains an essay titled "The Revised New Testament," that is pregnant with pertinent quotations. This essay is amazing as far as what it conveys and what it has in it from the Dublin Review. So when we talk about the Dublin Review, this is what we're dealing with, the Dublin Review. You can see this is the July through October edition, and this is also dating from 1881. So I forgot to mention here on the Free Religious Index, this is published. This publication date here of May 26, 1881 is within weeks, literally weeks of the release of the RV in May 1881. This one is within months from the Dublin Review. Okay. Now, if we go back to the notes, again, I'm going to read here. Let's just zero in here. Let's go to page 154. I'm going to be reading from my notes. But there's an article here on the revision of the New Testament, all right? And it is very long, and we don't have time to read all of it, but I would commend it to you, okay? Here they're talking about textual criticism and how it's a new science that has developed since 1611. I'm sure some people would let's go in here. Now, textual criticism is a tool belonging to rationalism. The revisers have borrowed it to help them revise their Bible. They have used the tool sparingly, but they have taught others to use it who are less gentle. With a volume Bible that was having notes of various editions and commentators, including variant readings from manuscripts or earlier editions, and good eyesight, even an ignorant man can revise his Bible for himself, and soon there will be no Bible to revise. If the first days of Protestantism private judgment fixed what Scripture meant, now textual criticism settles what Scripture says, and shortly higher criticism will reject the text and meaning alike. What has happened in Germany will happen in England. So again, Letus is not making it up. He is simply pointing out what occurred. Okay? As we saw in the last episode. All right? Now, I don't have time to read all this, but you can see that, but here the vital integrity of sacred Scripture is affected. By the sole authority of textual criticism, these men have dared to vote away some 40 verses of the inspired word. And then they talk about some examples here in Mark 16. The last 12 verses of St. Mark are detached from the rest of the gospel as if ready for removal as soon as Dean Bergen dies. What have the offended verses done that textual critics should tear them from their home of centuries in the Shire of God's temple? The sole offense of many is the careless copyists of some old unsealed manuscript skipped over them. They talk about it being a modern science. Omissions of the newly revised version. They talk about the deep anxiety as to its effect upon the religious mind of England and Scotland. It cannot but give a severe shock to those who have been brought up in the strictest sect of Protestantism. Their fundamental doctrine of verbal inspiration is undermined. These guys clearly thought that what was going on here was a threat and an undermining of Orthodox Protestant doctrine. There is simply no way around it. Okay. Again, I will leave a link to the description in these notes where you can read all this. The Catholic Church will gain by the new revision, both directly and indirectly, because old errors are removed from the translation. Indirectly, because the Bible-only principle is proven false. That would be the main tenet of Protestantism, sola scriptura. It is now at length too evident that the scripture is powerless without the church as the witness to its inspiration, the safeguard of its integrity, and the exponent of its meaning. And it will now be clear to all men which is the true church and the real mother to whom the Bible of right belongs. Nor will it need Solomon's wisdom to see that the so-called church, which heartlessly gives up the hapless child to be cut into pieces by textual criticism, cannot be the true mother. Whoa. Okay. Now you tell me that these guys understand what was going on. That was what they thought. I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth. This is a lengthy article in the Dublin Review right after the revised version was released. And do these guys think that what has gone on with this version is going to undermine the Protestant principle of sola scriptura, the Bible-only principle? It is simply not the case that these things don't impact doctrine, and everybody in the late 19th century knew it. They all knew it. But now we're way removed from that context, and we just believe what the Evangelical Academic Academy says. I know because I was taught this stuff when I was in Bible college. And then we have a third piece, the 1892 publication of the Bible, What It Is and Is Not, by Joseph Wood. So we'll come in here. The Bible, What It Is and Is Not, a series of Sunday evening lectures delivered at Old Meeting Church, Birmingham, by Joseph Wood. And the second edition is from 1892. All right. And we want to jump to page 59 on this one so that you can see what I'm quoting. And I'm quoting from the bottom here, this last paragraph, starting with the revised version. Okay. So we'll just read it here. The revised version is of great doctrinal significance. It tends to break down the rigidity of orthodoxy, and it justifies the liberal Christianity which we in this place hold and teach. We at any rate have every reason to be grateful for the help which the revised version gives us to a better understanding of the work of Christ and the apostles, who know the fatal force and fascination of words and have learned to realize the immense and inconceivable mistakes which have been made by nearly all English churches through the deficiencies and mistakes of the authorized version, welcome with deepest thankfulness the Bible which the revisers have placed in our hands as bringing before the English reader for the first time the true sense of the inspired writers. I know maybe at this point I sort of sound like a broken record, but did these guys think that this impacted doctrine? They think it was correcting all of the centuries of error that had occurred by people reading the authorized version. So again, the only reason why this should, and by the way, are these people sectarian? Do they view the revised version as helping their cause? So that, to me, that speaks to claim number one about how, you know, none of this. So here you have a Protestant Bible revised by the Anglican Church that is being received by the theologically unorthodox Protestants as helping their cause doctrinally. So to me, I think both of the principles that are established are by Dr. Leedy and that are then used by Brother Ward, both in his book and in his video, are truly on some shaky ground because historically they weren't true. But today everyone is just supposed to just sort of accept this mantra that no text variant impacts doctrine. Okay. So let me be clear. My position is I do not demand verbatim identicality of wording, but I do demand substantive doctrinal equivalence. There's a difference between a different way of saying the same thing and a substantive difference in meaning. What these pieces that I'm citing here demonstrate is that those folks at that time, they understood that there are substantive differences in meaning between what the AV, the authorized version, had to say and what it said and what the revised version said. And here are pieces like this where they are extolling the virtues of the revised version in undermining the mistakes of Protestant orthodoxy. But again, we're just supposed to buy the mantra that none of this, we shouldn't be worried about any of this. I think there are strong historical reasons to question that narrative. Okay, and then fourthly, we have the text and margins of the Revised New Testament affecting theological doctrine by George Vance Smith from 1881. George Vance Smith is the Unitarian that sat on the revision committee. Shortly after the release of the revised version, he writes this book talking about how the text and margins of the Revised New Testament affect theological doctrine. And again, this is a primary source to the release to the revised version. So the revised version went way beyond what it was supposed to do. If the revised version, if all they had done is updated spelling and syntax, and they just had sort of done those kinds of things, the same sorts of things that had been done to the text between 1611 and 1769, we probably wouldn't be even having these types of conversations. But it was revised on the basis of a new Greek text that no one had ever seen before, eclectically put together by textual choices of text critics. And so that's what like the Dublin Review piece is talking about. Okay. So now, Smith, he writes this book about how there are doctrinal issues in the text and margins of the AV. Okay. Now, this is from, what page is this? This is from page 6 of the introduction. At all events, it will be seen that the changes which have been introduced in the revised version have in several conspicuous instances an important bearing upon theological doctrine as usually derived from the New Testament. It is the design of the present tract to point out some of these instances and to offer a few remarks in elucidation of their theological import. So now we have a book written by a Unitarian who sat on the committee, who's now writing a book saying and showing to the reader how the choices of the committee impact theological doctrine. Okay, then we can go to page 50. And look at the conclusion. So I'm not reading all this, okay? You can read this stuff on obviously your own time or what have you. Search for these things. The doctrinal results of the revision. Since the publication of the Revised New Testament, it has been frequently said that the changes of the translation which the work contains are of little importance from a doctrinal point of view. So there's the mantra, okay? In other words, that the great doctrines of popular theology remain unaffected, untouched by the result of the revision. How far this assertion is correct, the careful reader of the foregoing pages will be able to judge for himself. to the writer, any such statement appears to be the most substantial sense contrary to the facts of the case for the following reasons. And then all of the reasons are listed out, and notice they're related to the deity of Christ. They're related to doctrines, okay? The only passage in the New Testament which seemed like a statement on the doctrine of the Trinity has been removed by the revisers as spurious. The sole deity of the Father has been reaffirmed in the remarkable case in which the authorized version had singularly misrepresented the original words. So there is no doubt that George Van Smith, who sat on the committee, is writing this book and saying, look, if you're going to say what is popularly said, that no doctrine is affected here, he is laying out and arguing to the contrary about why that is not true. So he obviously understood it from a particular point of view. Okay, so let me be clear again. I am not saying that the men on the collective are non-Orthodox. I'm not saying that they aren't Orthodox on their view of Christ. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm addressing here is the principle that no doctrine is impacted by text variant, and that we should not, that it should not matter. You cannot interpret what is in question or doubt or what isn't there. So I think there are serious historical reasons to doubt the mantra that no text variant impacts doctrine. I think Leda showed that. I think these primary sources here that we're looking at from the time period of how it was received in the late 19th century demonstrate that the revised version was celebrated by the theologically liberal and it was bemoaned by the religiously conservative. And that there's other quotes that we could pull, I just didn't have time, and that is once this happens, the Bible would be placed on the shelf. Actually, we saw that quote from Joseph. Was that one from Joseph Wood? I can't recall now. There's so many quotes swimming through my head. Or maybe that one, I think that one was from the Free Religious Index. Once the Bible is questioned as an infallible book, in the next century, it'll be placed on the shelf among all the general books of the world's religions. I would argue that to a large degree, in the English-speaking world, that exactly happened in the 20th century. So you can judge for yourself on these issues. I definitely have different thoughts about many of these things, both from a historical lens and also from just a general lens of reading my Bible, that if there are substantive differences in meaning between a King James and a modern version. So that's kind of where I'm at on this. I'm not sure if I'm going to do another video giving my thoughts on the collective. There are a few random statements that were made in the later episodes that I could spend time talking about, but I just don't know that there's enough there to justify entire episodes. So I might be done. I've got to give it some more thought. But I appreciate those of you who have listened. Hey, if you are enjoying the content on this channel, if you would consider liking the videos, leaving a comment, sharing them, sharing this channel with other people, we would certainly appreciate that. When we look at these things, a lot of what I've said has been bringing back stuff that I've taught in my From This Generation Forever class that's just sort of been sitting there for the last number of years. And if you're interested in the details of that class, there's a couple different formats that you can take in that information through. One of them is this blog, which I need to update. I said that last week, but I haven't gotten to it. And then another one is on the church's website, the From This Generation Forever class page. I just taught lesson 191 last week, and this goes all the way back to lesson one. If you're interested in looking at that content there. And then a third option that is sort of in process is I'm rebroadcasting the early episodes on our YouTube channel. And the reason I'm doing that is they used to be on the channel of one of the saints that attended our church and then has since moved away to a different state. And I'm trying to migrate that over. And as I'm doing that, I'm not only am I creating a master playlist, I'm creating some smaller topical playlists related to some of the subjects But we're rebroadcasting these on this channel every Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9 a.m. until we've exhausted that. And then I'm going to go back through and edit the rest and complete the playlist. So there's a lot of avenues, ways to get this information in more detail if you are interested in doing so. Please check that out. Appreciate you being a part of the audience. If you've never trusted Jesus Christ, if you've never relied exclusively on his shed blood for you on the cross, his death, his burial, his resurrection as the only total complete payment for your sin, the fact that you cannot save yourself, you cannot earn your own justification, but you need to rely and trust and place your faith into the faith of Jesus Christ, who died for your sin, he was delivered for your offenses, he was raised again for your justification. Trust the finished work of Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention.